Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is October 11th, 2013, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Thunderstruck, Subarachnoid Hemorrhages. And we have another guest skeptic this week. Yes, we have an expert from Ottawa, Dr. Jeff Perry. Now, Dr. Perry is a senior scientist in clinical epidemiology and an associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Ottawa. And you may recognize his name because it's all over those Ottawa ankle rules. Say hello, Jeff.
Hello.
Jeff, it's great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, I'm trying to be really nice to you, of course, because you've agreed to come on the show, but I'm going to hit you right off the bat with a really hard question, okay? I've got a bit of a problem, a bit of an issue. Why do you guys call it clinical decision rules? You know what us emerge docs are like. We like to break rules.
Well, we try to come up with clinical tools.
Tools. I like tools. Do you think we could talk to Ian Steele? Do you think you could convince him to call it a tool instead of a rule?
I think you'd have to break Ian first.
Clinical decision instruments? I mean, you know, rules are made to be broken. I guess I'd rather be called a rule than a tool, though.
Fair enough.
Well, I just had to get that off my chest right away because this whole clinical decision rules, maybe we'll just call it CDRs. CDRs. Make it a three-letter thing that I don't get so worked up about it. Anyways, Jeff, if you've had a chance to listen to the SGM podcast, you know that we always like to start with a clinical case scenario to get people into the sort of framework of what we're going to be talking today about. I put together a case of a 34-year-old woman who presents with acute onset of a headache, and it peaks within 30 minutes. So it's bam, 30 minutes, and she's got the peak headache. And she's had no recent trauma. Nobody pushed her down the stairs or anything. And you examine her, and she has no focal deficits, and she seems neurologically intact. And so the question and the reason we brought you on is, can a clinical decision rule be used to rule out a subarachnoid hemorrhage? But for some background, I just thought I'd get some information from you about headaches. You ever see a headache in the emerge there, Jeff?
Oh, from time to time, we definitely come across one. Yes, headaches are, as you know, they're a very, very common problem in the emergency and actually can account for 2% or more of all of our patients. Yet most of these headaches are quite benign and we just need to treat their pain. It's only a few that are of serious etiology, such as a subarachnoid hemorrhage.
And it makes it tricky because my understanding is that about half of the subarachnoid hemorrhage patients, so the ones that rule in for subarachnoid hemorrhage, present with no neurologic deficit.
That's right. So those are the tricky ones. The ones that come in with neurological deficits, either global, so they've got a diminished level of consciousness, or they're actually comatose, or focal deficits, even ranging from just a third nerve, an isolated third nerve palsy, or other deficits, they're easy to pick up because you need to investigate those patients. The other half, where they come in neurologically intact, they come in with a bad headache. And so trying to pick them out is quite challenging. And we know that although we do a reasonable job with just our clinical gestalt, we do miss a fair number of these potentially life-threatening or quality-of-life-threatening subarachnoid hemorrhages. And a previous study estimated this at about 5% of headache patients are actually missed on their first visit to the emerge.
So 1 in 20, you know. Most emerge docs, I don't think, would be happy with that miss rate, 1 in 20. We like to be closer to 99, 100% for those types of life-threatening conditions.
Yes, even though we don't like rules per se, we are somewhat obsessive and we tend to want to minimize the risk for the patients and to ensure that we're giving high-quality care. So I'd agree that certainly a 5% miss rate is too high.
Well, I don't know if you've been following along in the media in the last year or so, but there's been a bit of a dust-up about the workup for subarachnoid hemorrhages, because traditionally the workup has involved a non-contrast CT followed by a lumbar puncture. And it's not the CT that's come into question. so much as getting an LP routinely to rule out a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And our guest actually last week was Dr. David Newman. And he suggested that LPs are not always needed and estimated that the number needed to treat or the number needed of LPs to do to pick up one subarachnoid hemorrhage was 700. So I guess, are you part of the 700 club? Are you LPing all these people?
I'm not LPing all these patients. And certainly with our studies, we know that at our study centers, the physicians are not LPing all these people, and they are using clinical judgment, which is probably a good thing overall. There is still a high miss rate. Just randomly LPing everyone, as Dr. Newman points out, you'd have to LP about 700 to pick up one case. The question then is that even a clinically relevant case? Because many of the subarachnoid hemorrhages that are picked up by LP, many of them are not aneurysmal or are AVMs, and they're actually benign perimenes encephalic or non-aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage that don't always require any intervention, and more neurosurgeons are actually sending home directly from the emergency following negative angiography. So generally, when I broach the subject of performing a lumbar puncture with a patient, first off, it depends if it's the CT scan's been done soon after the headache onset. Certainly, our previous work demonstrated that if an early CT is done within 6 hours, that the sensitivity within our study was 100% with 95% confidence bands of 97% to 100%. So we know that the chances of missing a subarachnoid hemorrhage is very, very small. So I present it to the patient and say that, look, we have this the CT scan. We know that it's negative. We know from previous evidence that the risk is likely less than 1%. We can do another test, which is a lumbar puncture, and describe the test to the patient and let them decide. And they'll often ask me what my opinion is, whether or not I would, if it was a loved one, whether I'd suggest to them to have it done or myself. In that scenario, my answer is no. I wouldn't want it done.
I think that's I think that's a really key point for people to hear, is that if you've got that negative CT within 6 hours, and that's the study, right? Within 6 hours, you have that negative CT, you're looking at a sensitivity of 100% with really tight confidence intervals. So that's very reassuring.
It is. And will there be some patients that ultimately have a negative CT that's early that do have a subarachnoid hemorrhage? There will be some, because their patients are all different and they come in with different characteristics. There will eventually be that odd patient, but how many lumbar punctures are you going to do to pick up that one case?
Apparently 700, according to David Newman. And what you're talking about is that black swan event. And boy, if we practice medicine with the black swan event in mind, we're going to be doing a lot of harm, and we're going to be over-testing and over-diagnosing and over-treating people.
That's right. So unless the patient comes in, and if they have the perfect story, they have that instantaneously peaking headache, they have a strong family history of subarachnoid hemorrhages, or they come in with the perfect story, well, that patient, during my conversation, I might be trying to persuade them to consider the LP in that odd patient that's got the perfect story. Most of our patients that were worried about subarachnoid hemorrhage have somewhat of a less serious. It's worrisome enough that we're investigating for subarachnoid hemorrhage, where the onset to peak was in several minutes, and it's a new headache for them, or it's much more severe than any headache they've had before, whatnot, but it's not the perfect story. So unless it's really high pretest probability, my usual recommendation to the patient, if they ask during this discussion, is to forego the lumbar puncture and being reassured that their risk is less than 1%. The one caveat to that, which I would like to recommend, would be to remember that patients that are anemic, that blood does not show up well on CTs. So that is one additional consideration. If you have a patient that's quite anemic, such as the hemoglobin less than 90, that you should, in those cases, be a bit more cautious in terms of ruling out subarachnoid hemorrhage just on the CT.
Well, medicine's not a perfect sport, is it? And patients can be, well, complicated. And if they came to the eMERGE looking for guarantees, I think they've come to the wrong place. I mean, the only thing I can usually guarantee is that I'll always try my best. Jeff, let's get started talking about your paper, though. This was a big paper, and it just came out in JAMA in September. And we're always trying to cut the knowledge translation window from 10 years down to 1 year, but I don't think we've ever had something as short as 1 month. So this is really thrilling to have you on the podcast. So the paper itself, do you want to introduce the title of the paper?
Sure. So this paper is, as I said, was just published in JAMA. It's entitled Clinical Decision Rules to Rule Out Subarachnoid Hemorrhage for Acute Headache.
Now, we always go through the PICO just to get people framed up for that part of it, and it's part of the EBM method. And the population you had was adults, and adults were defined as 16 years of age and older, with their headache peaking within the first hour. And then your intervention was the application of three different clinical decision rules that you had put together. Oh, sorry, CDRs. There's no control in these types of situations. And then the outcome you were looking for was subarachnoid hemorrhages. And the definition that you used in this study was blood on CT, xanthochromium in the CSF, red blood cells in the last LP tube, and positive angiography. So that's the PICO. And then from a method standpoint, you had some interesting stuff in here. First of all, the methods were really, really good, Jeff. And I mean, you guys do an amazing job when it comes to working up these CDRs. So hats off to you. But it was a prospective multi-center cohort study, and there was 10 tertiary care hospitals involved, and you looked at consecutive patients, which is very important for bias. And these were patients that presented with non-traumatic headache that reached that maximum intensity within 1 hour. When you're reading a paper, it's really important to look at the inclusion and exclusion criteria. So I'll throw up the inclusion and exclusion criteria on the actual blog. But the inclusion, just to go through them quickly, was over 16 years of older, non-traumatic, peaked within less than 1 hour. They had to be GCS of 15 or Glasgow Coma Scale of 15. They weren't referred into from another center for this with the diagnosis of subarachnoid hemorrhage. And it wasn't a follow-up visit, right? And they were neurologically intact. When we go through this, you did some statistical stuff, and I was hoping you could help us out here because I noticed that you do have an appointment in the Department of Epidemiology, and I think I'm going to need some epidemiology help here because the fancy statistics that you did, one was called a multivariant recursive partitioning. Oh, Jeff, help me out. What is multivariant recursive partitioning when you're analyzing the data?
Multivariate recursive partitioning is a very complicated term for a very simple issue. And we use the recursive partitioning technique quite a lot, especially when we derive the rules. It allows us to make a final rule that basically has yes or no, so low risk, high risk. So it makes it very, very simple to use rather than having a given probability, which you get when you use logistic regression, which is another technique to develop CDRs.
So is it sort of like a decision tree where you have one variable, like they came in by ambulance, and that's the main trunk of a tree, and then you take a branch this way or a branch that way? And then,
that's right.
And then you just sort of go down the branches and see which fits best? Is that sort of?
Yeah, so your initial analysis, you'll look at the variable that's most statistically significant, and then it'll branch it into two groups, with it or without it. And for each group, you identify patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage. And what you ideally want to end up with is a one trunk of the tree or one branch of the tree going down where there's a group with no subarachnoid hemorrhages. And on the other side, you've through a series of steps, you come up with variables that ultimately identify all the cases of subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Hey, I think I'm starting to understand this. So you start out with one variable in the trunk of the tree, and then you have a yes-no decision. And I'm good at those sort of bimodal decisions. Yes, I go to the right, or no, I go to the left. And you just keep branching out and keep branching out until you find your result of subarachnoid hemorrhage or no subarachnoid hemorrhage.
That's right.
Hey, this is easy. It does have a fancy name for something that's not that complicated. I think I'm starting to understand it.
Now you're ready to be a senior scientist.
Oh, I don't think so. That brings me to the next statistical thing you did, and that was called bootstrapping. And I didn't know if that had to refer to, Ian Steele or something, that you would, I just want to bootstrap him because he keeps publishing all these great research reports. And of course, it's just, jealousy. You didn't actually bootstrap Ian Steele, did you?
No. When I went to go try and do that, he closed the door. And my boots weren't hard enough to go through his door. But no, in seriousness, bootstrapping, once again, it's a somewhat complicated sounding tool that's actually relatively simple. And all you're doing is taking the patients that you have, you're enrolled, and you're randomly creating another sample of patients by picking patients, sometimes more than once. You can pick them from your original data collection, so it picks them at random and gets a new sample that's the same size as your original. So obviously some patients will be picked multiple times, and then you do that several times, typically at least 100 or in our case up to 1,000 times. So you create 1,000 new samples and you rerun your analysis, and basically it tells you how stable your estimates are.
So you're just beating the data then in a post hoc analysis, just beating it over and over and over again, like you said, 1,000 times in this case, just to see about the stability of the results, to make sure
that's
that
right.
The results are stable and they don't change?
That's right. So in this study, we added two variables to create the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule by rerunning our recursive partitioning analysis and coming up with that. We then took our results and put them to our previous data set, so the one that was in BMJ in 2010, our original publication with the derivation of these original three rules, and we applied our new rule to that previous separate data set, so not this new one that we just published, and checked to make sure that our rule was stable in that separate data set.
Hey, I think I'm starting to understand multivariate recursive partitioning and bootstrapping. No wonder you're in the Department of Clinical Epidemiology. You mentioned results, though, so let's talk about the results. You had over 2,000 patients in this data set. I think there was about 2,700 eligible patients and then 2,100 patients that you actually were able to analyze. And when you looked at the demographics of these patients, they were middle-aged. And I must admit, that definition of middle-age is changing. It's getting older and older as I get older. But middle-age in this study was defined specifically as 44 years old was the mean age. 60% were women. A quarter of them arrived by ambulance. 83% got CTs. And listen to this, 39% got LPs. So when you talked about that standard of care, about not everybody getting LPs, in your institutions that were involved in the study, just over a third got LPs. And the final diagnosis of subarachnoid hemorrhage was 6.2%. Explain this to me, Jeff. You had 600 patients that were eligible, but you didn't actually analyze. How did that happen?
Right. So this was a prospective cohort study. And what we had the doctors do was at all the 10 participating sites, they would fill in a paper form before they did the CT, and they would indicate the three candidate rules, which variables were present for their patient, as well as a few other variables that we thought might be important if we had to or chose to further refine the rules. So if the physician did not complete one of these forms, we had a process in place where we had our research assistants would go back and look through the patient census logs to identify any missed eligible patients. And in our study, we took a very conservative approach to this, and any patient that we couldn't definitely exclude based on our eligibility criteria, they were considered potentially missed eligible patients. So what I mean by that is one of our eligibility criteria was peaking within 1 hour. Well, if you've ever looked at physician charting, to actually pull that out of that chart, it's not always a straightforward process, such as it's impossible. You can't always tell if the headache peaked within an hour or not. So if we could not clearly, definitively tell that it peaked within an hour or peaked in a period greater than 1 hour, we consider them a missed eligible patient. And this is important for an assessment for bias, because we essentially want to make sure that the patients that weren't enrolled were at least similar to those that were enrolled, and we didn't want to overestimate our ability to enroll patients and falsely reassure patients. We are physicians that in our results, we want to make sure that we gave them the worst case scenario in terms of our recruitment. And fortunately, our physicians at our 10 participating sites were fantastic and really helped us out and by filling in these data forms in most cases of patients.
Yeah, and you did identify those 605, which was 22% of the data set. And when you looked at the demographics, they were very, very similar to the demographics of your analyzed data, with, again, the mean age being in the mid-40s, about 60% being women, about a quarter arriving by EMS, 83% got CT scans, 38% got LPs, and then that final rule-in rate was 5.5%, or almost 6% for subarachnoid hemorrhage. So those patients seem very similar to the actual data set that you analyzed.
That's right.
So when you looked at all three rules, because you tested three different rules, they had a sensitivity and specificity that ranged between 96 to 99% for sensitivity, and the specificity was between 28 and 36%. And all three rules missed a few subarachnoid hemorrhages. No rule was perfect of those three rules, but no subarachnoid hemorrhages were missed by all three rules. So there were different misses among the rules. But rule number one, and that's the one we're going to talk about, it identified 130 out of 132 subarachnoid hemorrhages. So it missed two. And it's important, when you miss patients, it's important to know what happened to those patients. So, Jeff, what happened to those two misses by rule number one?
Yeah, so for these two patients, one of the subarachnoid hemorrhages was arguably not clinically significant. They had a small amount of subarachnoid blood on their CT in one of the frontal sulci, and they had a negative angiography. They were actually discharged home directly from the emergency department. They came back to the emergency almost a week later, had another scan which was completely normal, and were sent home again by neurosurgery, and subsequently did perfectly well and didn't have any adverse events.
So from a patient-oriented, not a disease-oriented, yes, there was blood there on that first CT, but from a patient-oriented outcome, and we're interested in poo, not dose, but from a patient-oriented outcome, they wouldn't really care. If I have blood in my head right now, I'm not really bothered by that as long as I'm feeling well and neurologically intact.
Yeah, and not going to get worse.
Right, exactly. So that's one patient. What happened to that other patient that was missed by rule number one?
So the other patient was a young lady that hadn't was negative by the rule one, and they ultimately had a positive lumbar puncture, went on to see neurosurgery, and actually en route rebled while waiting for the neurosurgeons to assess at another institution. They went on to have operative management, and in the end actually did reasonably well in alive and mostly well. They have some residual weakness at the last time we checked in terms of their arm function. They have certainly some function with it, but they have some weakness. But it was an aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage that of the likes we ideally would not want to miss.
And so because of that, isn't that how you came up with adding those two other variables to rule number one? Because there was four variables in rule number one, but didn't you sort of look through the data and then find those additional things so that you could bring the rule up to 100% sensitivity?
Yeah, so what we then did was, after a series of discussions amongst the co-investigators, we ultimately felt that we ought to try to refine the rule to improve the sensitivity. And so we reran the multivariate recursive partitioning, which you now know how to do, and came up with the four variables in rule one with the addition of two other variables.
Now, was that thought of a priori, or was that data dredging after? Did you already decide that before you did this, you were going to run this again, or did you decide after that missed patient?
No, part of the methodology with CDR research is during the validation phase, you are supposed to rerun the analysis to see if you can improve your rules. And by improve, I mean either improving the sensitivity or ideally rerun them to improve the specificity. In this case, we ended up having to rerun it. We reran it to improve the sensitivity, but it was pre-planned to do this. You ideally don't want to change your rules because then that means you need to embark on further validation if you change anything in your rule.
Well, I just wanted the listeners to know that this was done as part of the original methodology, and it wasn't data dredging. It was a priori. Before the study started, you had decided to do this, and it wasn't because rule number one missed a couple of patients with one being clinically significant.
No, it was part of our plan from the outset to rerun the analysis, once again, hoping that we wouldn't have to change anything or decide that we did already have the best rule. But in this particular case, we felt it was optimal to present this new rule, albeit recognizing that rule one, despite missing these two cases, is likely better than current clinical practice. And in many countries around the world, they may look at rule one and say, you know what, that's good enough. However, I think that many physicians, certainly in North America, still aimed for near perfection, which has problems with it, such as the quest for perfection is probably a bit of an enemy because we end up over testing patients in that endless pursuit of perfection. But in this particular case, we felt that it was optimal to revise the rule to come up with the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule where it's going to be near perfect.
So yeah, you increase sensitivity to 100%, but at the cost of specificity, dropping it down to 15%. Okay, so Jeff, let's talk about the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rules. There were two additional things that you added to the original four, and it was called rule number one at that point, and there were four things involved in that. But you added thunderclap headache, and thunderclap, that's where we got the podcast theme today for thunderstruck. A little tip of the hat for the AC/DC fans out there and the Aussie listeners. So thunderstruck or thunderclap headache, and then limited neck flexion was added to rule number one. Rule number one, the four components of that were age greater than or equal to 40. Neck pain or stiffness was the second variable. The third variable was a witness loss of consciousness. And then the fourth thing was onset during exertion. So with those four things, you added thunderclap, so peaked within a second, thunderclap instantaneously, and then limited neck flexion on examination. Jeff, I'm kind of a simple guy. I like five things, but I think six is probably okay because I can probably combine the neck pain or stiffness with the neck limited neck flexion on examination. Well, if rule number one had been used, then looking at utilization, you would have dropped your investigation rate down from about 84% to 74%. However, with this modified, the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule, the modification, the adding of thunderclap and limited neck flexion, that would have increased the investigation rate back up to the mid-80s, 86%. But you're not missing people, right?
That's right. And we sought to make sure that the rule was going to increase safety and patient and improve patient outcomes, albeit at the desired result would have also been to drop investigations. But we consider that secondary to patient safety.
I understand. So this is the first time on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine that I don't actually have to quote the author's conclusion because I can get the lead author himself, you, to give the conclusion of the paper.
Our conclusion was, among patients presented to the emergency department with acute non-traumatic headache that reached maximal intensity within 1 hour and who had normal neurological findings, the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule was highly sensitive for identifying subarachnoid hemorrhage. These findings only apply to patients with these specific clinical characteristics and require additional evaluation in implementation studies before the rule is applied in routine emergency clinical care.
So just some final comments on that and then a bottom line. Some comments I had on it. Again, Jeff, congratulations. A very, very well done, large, multi-center, prospective study. And that the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule is simple. I joke around about the five thing, but this is simple. And it only contains six variables. And applying this clinical decision tool, see how it keeps sliding that in there, could decrease the miss rate of subarachnoid hemorrhage from the community standard of about 5% down to almost 0%, with only a slight increase in utilization. And it remains to be seen if the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule would have the same impact in other healthcare systems with different practice environments. Now, there are some critics out there, Jeff, who say that, you know, the brain is way too complicated and subarachnoid hemorrhage, I mean, really, can a clinical decision tool work in this area? I think regardless, you've shown that it does have significant potential to work, and we should always try to use evidence-based medicine to increase patients' choices in shared decision-making. Now, the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule may turn out to be a great way to frame that conversation with patients presenting with a potentially life-threatening condition. Jeff, you had some final comments about how we may move forward with this.
Yes, certainly. So as we have validated the rule one, we know that it works most of the time. And we only missed basically out of the 132 positive cases in this cohort and another similar cohort beforehand, we only missed two cases, only one of which was clinically significant, arguably. So we know that rule one is highly effective. For the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule, we simply added two variables to that. So I would certainly argue that clinicians should now use the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule to identify high-risk patients. So if patients have one or more of these variables, they should strongly consider investigating them for subarachnoid hemorrhage. However, it's not, because we have modified the rule, it is not ready to use to do in the reverse situation to exclude investigations for low-risk patients. That you still need to use your clinical judgment and await further validation of the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule.
I'm going to go out on a limb here. And I'm just way out on the limb here. You're not going to rest on your laurels, are you? You're going to go ahead and validate this?
We're almost done.
No way. So you're almost done already?
Yeah, we've been going full speed, nonstop. And this cohort ended in 2010. And we immediately shifted gears to the validation of the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. So we are hoping to complete validation in the near future and hopefully have the results published sometime next year.
Those steel wheels keep on turning, don't they?
They do.
All right, the bottom line for today's podcast is then the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool is not ready for prime time in low-risk patients. So let's go back to the original case then, Jeff. We were clinically concerned about this 34-year-old woman, and we go ahead and get a non-contrast CT head, which is negative. You discuss the risks and benefits of the LP with the patient. A shared decision is made not to go ahead with the LP, and she is discharged home with appropriate analgesia. She is to return to the emergency department if she develops focal neurologic symptoms, her pain increases, she has a loss of consciousness, a seizure, or she's otherwise worried. We have a Keener contest, Jeff, and our Keener contest winner last week was Colleen Sweeney, a family medicine resident out in Nova Scotia, Canada. Great job. She knew that the NNT for ACLS drugs in cardiac arrest is essentially zero or infinite because no patient benefited, and that benefit would have been survival to hospital discharge. So congratulations to her. And in honor of Jeff and the Ottawa group and Ian Steele, we're going to do a question about probably the best known clinical decision tool out there, and that's the Ottawa ankle tool. They've been validated in adults. They've also been validated in children. And the question is, to what age can you apply the Ottawa ankle tools to decide whether or not that child needs an x-ray? If you know how low those tools go, just send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener Contest in the subject line. And if you're the first person to correctly answer that question, I will send you that cool skeptical prize. Now, Jeff, we're going to be posting this episode while I'm attending ASEP in Seattle next week. Are you going to ASEP?
Unfortunately, not able to make it this year.
Not this year. Well, anybody who is going to ASEP, make sure you come up to me and say hello, and I might give you a cool skeptical prize. Jeff, I always ask our guests to give the tagline. Would you be nice enough to give the Skeptic's Guide tagline for today's show?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.